Okay, thank you for the invitation. It's good to be here again so far from home. So today I'll be talking about some work that I've done over the past couple of months with Peter and his two papers, with Ami Hanani and also with his group at MIT. So what the work involves was we discovered a connection between, we wanted to study Clifford Gauge theories. And, well, this is not how we actually, what we did was we were studying Clifford Gauge theories, and we found a connection to a branch of mathematics and physics called Dunning models. So I'll explain what they are, and what we can learn from them about Clifford theories. So, Dunning have been studied in the physics and math literature for almost four decades now. And so there's very studied models, and there's a lot of results known and a lot of mathematical properties in the known. And so using this connection to Clifford theories, we're in the process of translating and extending the results to such things about Clifford. So in my talk, I'll start by reviewing what is the Gauge theory side, what are we hoping to study with this project. And then the key observation that we had was that we can combine the data of the quiver gauge theory into something we call the planar quiver, and this encapsulates more of the structure that these theories have, so it manifests in the way that's usually presented. And this is where the connection to the Dynamo models comes in, the dynas are realized in string theory in terms of some intersecting NS5 and D5 brains. This is a way of actually constructing the quiver theory. And by observing that these brain constructions have some structure, this is where the dynas come into it. And so then we can use technology dyna models to study these theories and then learn things about the quivers. Okay, so to start, let me review what are the class of gauge theories we're interested in studying. So these things have N+1 supersymmetry in four dimensions. The gauge group has a product structure. We can take the ranks to be arbitrary. For my talk, I'll be taking the ranks actually to be equal. I'll be interested in a subclass of Clifford theories. And the matter content that we can have is basically two index matter. We can have bifundamental matter transforming between different gauge groups, and or we can have adjoint matter where both indices are in the same gauge group. So the way it's usually represented is by drawing a quiver diagram. So the nodes in the quiver diagram represent the gauge groups. So here there are three gauge groups in this example, and then the matter content is drawn as arrows indicating the two representations of the matter field. So an adjoint field is an arrow going back to the same node, and then a bifundamental is a directed arrow going between two gauge groups. So this describes the matter content of the theory. In order to complete the description, you need to specify a superpotential, giving you directions. And so a superpotential is said to be a gauge invariant. Consists of certain closed paths on the quiver diagram. So the one I've drawn here, x21, x12, x23, x32, is the first term, and this is a particular closed path in the quiver. So both of these pieces are needed to specify the theory. Then one thing we'll be able to study later on is the moduli space of these theories. And so in string theory, the moduli space is just these quiver theories arise by taking some D3 brains that live at a singular point in some internal Calabi R. And the moduli space is basically the geometry of this Calabi R manifold. You can obtain this from field theory by looking at the DNF terms. And string theory, the construction is you look at D3 grain probing the singular geometry. Okay, so the subclass of quiver theories that I'm interested in are toric quivers, which is where we take all the ranks of the nodes, ranks of the gauge groups to be equal. And this corresponds to, turns out, that the Calabi-Yau threefold is a non-compact toric variety. So this is a restriction. It turns out this restriction imposes extra structure on the theory that that we can make use of. So these things have been studied in great detail in literature. I should mention, so the original work about quiver gauge theories and string theory goes back to Douglas and Moore. And most of the work I'll be talking about is related to work done by Hanani and collaborators in this paper and much subsequent work. And this is really the work that we've improved on generalized in this work with diamonds. So the essential content of their papers, they were looking at trying to compute the moduli space, or going between the moduli space of the quiver theory and the quiver theory. So the two questions you want to ask are, given a quiver theory, a toric quiver, how can you systematically compute the moduli space? And they gave an algorithm for doing this, a computational algorithm that you can put on a computer. And then conversely, given some toric threefold, how can I find a toric quiver that has that space and this moduli space? So these are called the forward and inverse algorithms. So one key point is that these were both very computationally expensive, the exponential time operations. So the observations that we made allow us to make use of extra structure that's present in the toric theories that previous constructions hadn't made use of. And so what, well, it amounts to, because the quiver theory and superpotential are written separately, as I had before, that structure isn't manifest. And by combining them in a certain way, we're able to exploit that. So there have been some previous observations of that extra structure that these four quivers had, and these will be explained by the diamond construction. So the first thing is that every field that appears in the superpotential appears exactly twice, and the two occurrences have opposite signs. The sign of the term of the superpotential, one is plus, one is minus. And it has also been observed that there's an Euler relation between the number of gauge groups, the number of superpotential terms, and the number of fields, matter fields. This had no previous previous explanation. But in fact, this is suggesting that there should be a torus electron in here, something of genus 1. And we noticed that with the toric theories, you can always rewrite the quiver so there's a plane graph on the torus, and so, as it suggests, the superpotential terms correspond to faces of the graph. So this is really the key observation, that that looking in these toric quivers, there's always a plane graph, and where the superpotentials now has a preferred status. Before, these were arbitrary piles in the quiver, as the quiver is usually drawn, but here, because we have a preferred embedding of the quiver on the torus, that comes with a preferred meaning for the superpotential.
I have a question.
Yes.
So n in around of the gauge group,
yes,
stands for the number of D3 grains?
Number of D3 grains. So if you had some n D3 grains probing at a singular point in the geometry, that will give you a toric quiver where all the ranks are equal to n.
Right. So the moduli space you expect is the symmetric product of a toric product, right?
Yes. I think so. What we usually think of is taking n to be 1, and this is only a signal description, and you just have one copy of the toric space. But I think you can probably think of it as a symmetric product, because there are basically going to be n points on the on the internal space.
Oh, that your gauge group is not SUN but UN? Or?
It's SUN, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
Perhaps UN is what I really want. What I'll be talking about is suppressing the end and what I really want to think of as N equals 1. But I believe, well,
for N equals 1, you take a U1.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So U1 is the one. So I guess it's really UN, and maybe you can argue that there are some U1 factors to decouple for the. Greater than one. Yes, this point actually isn't very clear in literature, so I'm not sure it's understood, but that's not something I'm
Another question is,
yes.
When you said D and F solve D and F question. So the modular space you're talking about in gauge theory is classical modular space, or is it fully quantum?
What I'm wondering is are there any are there going to be any corrections? I'm not certain if we're looking at the plasma modular space and you have to worry about if parts are lifted or if you can argue that there are no corrections. I'm not sure about that.
Well, you are talking about plasma.
At least the plasma, yes. And yes, it could be that some of it is lifted or could be that you can argue there are no corrections. I believe it's actually the exact modular space because these constructions appear in ADS-CFT, for example, the conifold, where if you have D3 grains sitting at the tip of the conifold, their modular space, according to ADS-CFT arguments, is going to be the conifold. So that should include the quantum corrections. And that has been generalized to other such compact torus spaces. Okay, so here's an example of this plane quiver construction. So this is a particular toric quiver. I'll be using this example throughout the talk. So there are four gauge groups. There are 10, 12 matter fields. Here there's double arrows, meaning there are two arrows between these two nodes, and I've labeled them with green. And so this is a particular superpotential that goes along with this quiver. So we write it as a planar graph, it's done here. So you can see that, for example, the first term, x minus 10, x 8, corresponds to this triangular face of the planar quiver. And similarly, the other eight faces of the other terms in the superpotential. The other eight faces here, and in order to do this, we had to make use of faculties on a torus, where things need to wrap around the cycles of the torus in order to keep it planar. So you can also see here that you see the property that, so for example, the X10 field appears here, and the signs are opposite, which translates to the property that adjacent faces of this planar quiver you can label them with an opposite sign. Okay, so another way to say this construction is that we think of these terms in superpotential as giving us some polygon faces, and we just glue them together along their edges, and because well, the statement that each field appears twice is the statement that two faces, only two faces join together along each edge. So we're going to get a tiling of the surface And wherever the surface has no boundary, it follows there precisely each face joins precisely two others, not one. So this is an explanation for the Euler relation here. We actually get a tiling by polygons of the torus. So this was the planar quiver, and one thing that's an obvious operation to do when you have a planar graph is to take a planar dual graph, and the planar dual graph I've drawn here. So here there's an eight-element vertex which translates into an octagon, and similarly here's a quadrilateral, another octagon. So the dual graph of this planar quiver is drawn here, and now the vertices become the faces of the dual graph, and the property that adjacent faces of the quiver were oppositely signed translates into the statement that adjacent vertices of the dual graph have opposite sign, and I can draw them with an opposite color. It may not be clear, but I've alternated black and white, or open and closed, around each of the around every vertex. So that property is called bipartiteness. It means that you can give a sign to one of two colors to each vertex, so that adjacent vertices have opposite color. So our claim is that this dual bipartite graph is actually physical in the sense that it exists in string theory as a way to construct this gauge theory we started with. I'll explain that just a moment. And then the use of this construction mathematically is that these bipartite graphs are very well studied in mathematics and statistical mechanics and physics. And this is where data models are naturally defined. And so we can then use these data model methods to try and study the theory. So there's been much previous work about constructions of quiver gauge theory for Benefit 1 supersymmetry in terms of intersecting webs of D5 and NS5, with D brains and NS5 brains. I listed some of the references here that are relevant. The one I'm drawing here is the brain box construction for Panani and Flowrotors. So what you have is these are the blue lines, are NS5 brains, which are stretched along. So they have four directions in common, and then the other two directions are distinct. And then in the, as I've drawn here, the 4-6 plane, there are D5 brains that live parallel to the plane of the screen. So this was proposed as a way of constructing these quiver gauge theories. But in order to do that, they had to propose some rules for how you obtain things like the metacognitive and superpotential. And the rules that were proposed were that the bifundamental fields are oriented in this direction. So there are three of them. And this is, you can see, a little bit ad hoc. I mean, they didn't, as far as I know, motivate why there should be an arrow going through this diagonal vertex, but the other two should be going between along the edges. And so while they were able to reproduce known features of the quiver theories from this construction they proposed in string theory, there are some features about it that are puzzling. So the advantage that we have from this picture here. So you can see firstly that it reproduces the previous construction, the brain box construction. If we take this pair of opposite edges to zero size, then this hexagon will become a rhombus, a parallelogram, and you see this feature is now also on a better, more sound footing. The edges that we now have arrows only going through edges, not vertices. So the proposal is that this bipartite graph that we obtained from the quiver theory describe the graph, the edges of the graph describe NS5 brains, just as in the previous construction, and again the faces correspond to D5 brains, and now the matter fields as previously, come from fundamental strings that stretch between two sets of divide brains, going across the tennis five brain between them. But now, everything's on a symmetric footing here, the orientation of the stretched strings is induced from the orientation of the bipartite graph. So the graph, we can give an orientation by saying, for example, we always go from the black vertex to the white vertex. And so that gives an orientation, prescribes an orientation for the NS5 brains. And then the stretched string going with one orientation survives and the other one's projected out. And this gives the chiral matter. And you can also see from this picture that when you have a vertex, this corresponds to an area where multiple strings can interact. You can get a closed loop of strings localized around a vertex. And this is where it corresponds to the interaction terms and the superpotential. So we call these constructions brain tilings because we're basically tiling a torus using polygons, which correspond to D5 brains. And so it's actually quite easy to write down. So given any Kudu theory, you can write down directly this bipartite graph. And you do that by basically, here is a gauge group. The fields that are charged into the gauge group are the boundary of the polygon. And then you glue together these boundaries according to the rules according to the terms in the superpotential. And conversely, you can write down just by seeing the different arrangements of these polygons to give a time to the torus, you can write down possible theories or possible superpotentials with the same quiver. These two planar diagrams I've shown you, the planar quiver and this dual bipartite graph, are ways of encoding both pieces of data of the quiver and its superpotential into one diagram. And so I've mentioned several times that we can use Zeier models to study these bipartite graphs. So the Zeier model is interested in looking at combinatorics of edges on the graph. So you define a matching to be a set of edges of the graph so that each vertex has one edge in the matching incident to it. So I've drawn one of them here in red. And of course, there are many possible matchings. Another matching might be along these edges, and so on. So the Zeier model is interested in counting the number of matchings of these graphs. And this has lots of applications in statistical mechanics, and mathematicians are interested in studying it on their own for their own combinatorial purposes. So Castellane did some of the very seminal work in the 1960s, and it's been recently studied by this group of authors and many others. So the main tool in looking at the properties or that encodes the properties of these diamond models is what's called the Castellane matrix, which is basically the adjacency matrix to the graph with some extra weights and signs thrown into it, as I'll show you. So in general, you can give weights to the edges of the graph, and because the superpotentials that I wrote down and that have been usually studied are normalized to have all the coupling constants equal to 1. That says that to be the same as normalizing all the edge weights to 1. In general, these can be arbitrary complex numbers. And so whenever there's an entry in the adjacency matrix, it appears with the weight of the edge. So we'll be fixing all the edge weights to 1. The Castellane matrix, you need to assign signs to the edges according to this rule, so that the parity of the edge weights multiplied around every face it is either odd or even, depending on whether there are two or zero mod four edges in that face. Okay, so there are many possible ways of citing the sign, and these are all equivalent, well, physically equivalent. So the third step is to assign some x and weights, some factors of z and w according to this rule. So you look at the cycles of the torus, the winding cycles of the torus, and then so these are basically cards in the dual graph. And so I've drawn them here. Here's the 0-1 cycle, the 1-0 cycle, here's the 0-1 cycle of the torus. And every time this part crosses an edge, I give it a weight, I give that edge a weight of z, power of z, and the power is determined by the orientation with which I cross the edge. So here I cross with the black node on my right, and so I chose the chosen convention to give that a 1 over z weighting. And then here I now have the black node on my left, and so this has the opposite weight. Okay, so there are similarly the W's are assigned to that path. So now I've dressed this graph with some extra factors. And I just write down its adjacency matrix. So, for example, I've chosen conventions that the rows are indexed by the open nodes, and the columns are indexed by the black nodes. And so, for example, here from 1 to 1 prime, the edge weight is 1. From 1 to 4 prime, the edge weight is, like I've used the opposite conventions here. It should be 1 over W and a W there instantly. So here's 1 over W. And so this is the Castellane matrix. And now, the key properties of this are the determinant of the Collins matrix. So I've taken the determinant. And in general, it was shown that the determinant of this Castellane matrix is solving a particular combinatorial problem for you, and it's counting the number of closed curves on this graph, counting them with certain according to a certain grading and according to a certain time. So it always has this form, and let me explain what these numbers C are. Okay, so how do we obtain curves on this graph? So firstly, we take an arbitrary matching, which I call this reference matching M0. And I've drawn this, for example, the green one here is reference matching. And then for every other matching, I can take the difference of those. So because there's an orientation here which I've sort of induced, but the orientation would be from the black to the white, and then here is now white to black. So this arrow would actually be going the other way because I've taken minus M. I'll go around, but because it's a relative minus sign there, we get a compatible orientation, and this gives me some closed curves on the graph. So there may actually be more than one curve, so it's going to be a sum of curves. But the point is, I want to look at the height change as I go around the two cycles of the torus. So what I do is I pick some starting point. Some starting space of the graph, and then for every adjacent face, if I haven't crossed these curves I've obtained, the height doesn't change. But as I cross from here, I cross this curve, and so my height will increase. I've crossed it with positive orientation, and now as I go up again, I've crossed the curve with negative orientation, so the height change decreases, the height function decreases. So the numbers that Blake is the counting of these curves are these height changes along the Z cycle and along the W cycle of the torus. So here's an example of a matching that has no height change along either cycle, and then here's a matching that has no change along the Z, but it has a change in plus one around the W cycle. So this is the grading if I count these curves. And that's what appears in the determinant. So, for example, here, this tells me, this is the example I did previously, it tells me that there's one curve that has height change, 1 along the Z direction, plus 1, and 0 along the W direction. there are five curves that have zero height change on both directions and so on. And you can write this out and actually verify that. So the point where we make contact with toric geometry is that this determinant, if we look at the degrees of the monomials, so the degrees in W and Z, then when we plot these in the Z2 plane, we get a convex polygon. And this convex polygon is the toric diagram of the Calabi-Yau space. It's the moduli space of the Clifford theory. So this was our initial observation in the first paper that I had with Ami. And so at that stage, we made this observation, and at that stage we didn't understand why it should happen. But it turns out this is true in general. And so for any Clifford theory, this is actually a simple way to calculate its moduli space. You just need to construct this graph, this dual bipartite graph, take the determinant of the Castellane matrix, and then you see you can read off the toric diagram, and from this you can also read off the charges of the linear sigma model. These numbers actually turn out to have meaning for the linear sigma model. These are multiplicities of fields, which is something we also get for free from this construction. Firstly, were there any questions about the steps I followed to get to this point? Okay, so just first. So let me summarize what I've done so far. So we started with a Clifford theory and a superpotential, and then the first step I did was to rewrite these two pieces of data as a plane equivalent. And now the dual graph, this plane equivalent, gives me a bipartite graph. The bipartiteness came from the fact that that each field appears with opposite signs in the superpotential. And so we propose this as a construction of these Clifford theories and string theory. I think there's more work to be done here. For example, we don't. One thing we haven't thought about in detail is looking at supersymmetry of this gradient path. From the point of view of the diamond model, it doesn't care what is the embedding of this graph in the torus. These lines don't have to be straight. All we care about is the topological properties. But clearly from string theory, there are constraints on the angles with which these things have to intersect in order to preserve supersymmetry. That isn't something that I've thought a lot about, but it's something I'm starting to think about now. For example, you can always rewrite these brain tilings, or these bipartite graphs, so that all the angles are right angles. And this is a matter of choosing how you adjoin neighboring ranks to each other. So here I've rewritten this square octagon graph as a graph where all the angles are right angles. So one thing we've been studying recently is looking at trying to understand A maximization for these Clifford theories. So it's been known as the work of Beck and Schilligator. So if you want to study these theories should have a superconformal fixed point, and if you want to study what is the asymmetry of that superconformal fixed point, there's a principle for A maximization, which tells you which of the candidate R charges, R symmetries, is the one that is the R symmetry in the infrared. And one way that this can appear in these diamond constructions is based on the angles of the opening angles between intersections of brains. Is basically it's the R charge of the adjacent field normalized by pi. And so you can see, so there are a couple of constraints that you have on the R charge. The first one is that that the R charge of the superpotential has to be equal to 2. And this follows from the assignment of angle of R charges to angles, because obviously around every vertex, the vertices, remember, were the terms in the superpotential, the sum of the angles has to be 2 pi. And then you can, if you look at other things, like, you want the beta functions need to vanish. So the beta functions for all the gauge groups have to vanish. And it turns out that you can, this condition is also reproduced. Basically, what you do there is, so for every, in the original, there's a more symmetric way. But for every edge in the graph, every face, we look at the, we can construct some rhombi. So we take the point inside the face, and then for every edge, we turn the edge for these 2 points into a rhombus. So here's a field, so let me call this phi. And so concretely what I meant here about the angles is that the angle sort of that's incorporates this edge phi is related to the R charge. So here is where alpha is the R charge of phi over pi. And now if you take a particular embedding of this graph, so that these quadrilaterals I've drawn are actually all rhombi, then so being a rhombus means this angle here. Firstly, these angles are both equal. Clearly, this has to be true if I want this angle to give me the R charge of this field, then they both have to agree. And now, for this to be a rhombus, that means that these angles are also equal, and they're given by pi minus alpha. And so it turns out you can translate the condition that the beta function vanished, the beta function of this gauge group and this gauge group, etc., is the condition that these rhombi that will meet at a point here, firstly, and then this some of these angles being equal to 2 pi is equivalent to the beta functions of the gauge groups vanishing, the gauge couplings vanishing. So what we found is that there's a particular embedding of the graph, of the bipartite graph, that agrees with the A maximization. I said that there are particular embeddings that agree with the conformal fixed point in the infrared. Now, it turns out there are families of such embeddings, and these families correspond to being able to deform the angles alpha and then therefore beta. This corresponds to the mixing of the U1R symmetry with the other U1 global symmetries. So this is a way you can see, you translate this property of the mixing of the R symmetries into the Dynamo model language, and then these families of rhombic embeddings. There's a particular preferred one which is given by the A maximization principle. So the preferred embedding in this case, it turns out trace of R, so A is given by the trace of R, and then some coefficient, relative coefficient, trace of sum of R cubed. It turns out for these theories, trace of R is always 0 for the beta function. And so we maximize trace R cubed over the space of angles of these embeddings. And that agrees that is actually A maximization translated to this language. So this is a prescription for relating angles of the Dynamo model of the bipartite graph to. Is there a question?
So you're saying that there is a mixing the R symmetry with global symmetry, and
yes.
Under the mixing, the beta function will still vanish.
I guess you're computing beta functions, including the number of dimensions. Right?
Yes. So this is the problem that was studied by Bunchel anyway. In general, you don't know which one of these is the arc symmetry in the infrared, and this is the principle for finding it. And it turns out that these things do come in families which agree with these
arc symmetries. So that ambiguity extends to beta functions.
Sorry?
That ambiguity extends to the beta functions, ambiguity to the
numbers. Yes, yes.
Okay.
So what we have here is a way of translating this property of studying frame recommendation into the Dyna language, but by choosing a particular embedding of this graph. What I've proposed is true, that this bipartite graph is something physical that we can think of as being living in string theory and giving us intersections of the brain, then this should be compatible with supersymmetry of this. So this is something I'm in the process of thinking about. For example, if this is true, you should be able to derive from the constraint of supersymmetry and also advantage of beta function and A maximization that there is this particular embedding that of the framework that gives you that. So that's something that's in progress. So at this point, when I was discussing the brain tiling, I kind of made this jump to now introducing the Dyna model. So this is kind of an obvious thing to do, knowing about the mathematics, but it's not motivated from any physics. So I didn't motivate it, and I actually don't know how to motivate this from string theory, because the problem that we're studying here, we're studying counting of matching, so sort of excluded edges of this graph, and if that's true, there should be some. We can prove that this gives you the right answer, but we don't know in string theory. What are we doing? What are we counting on this configuration? What is it we're counting? These things are particular NS5 range, but some things localized particular NS5 range, and then we're counting closed paths on this NS5 web, but we don't know why we should be doing that. So it works, we can prove that it works, but we don't know why from string theory. The next step then was to, if we take the determinant of this graph, then we can compute the moduli space that the thing started with. And this is actually a much shorter route. So very complicated quiver theory. This is a long computation, and it turns out going through this route of going through diamonds is actually a shortcut. So now there's another interesting thing that comes in here, which is to do with mirror symmetry. So here we have a toric space. Here's what's usually called like this toric diagram, and it may also be more familiar. So if I take the planar dual to this graph, I get this thing, which is the PQ web. It describes some PQ fibrains that intersect, and it's one way of constructing the same space. You can also look at it as the degeneration of the U1 action of the toric freefall. So the point is, here's a particular non-compact toric freefall. And then under mirror symmetry, this maps to a collabial, which is basically this quadratic factor, and then plus a function, which is a function of two variables. This part of it, setting p equal to 0, gives me a Riemann surface. And this Riemann surface is precisely what you get from this Castellane matrix. So in other words, here, in order to compute the moduli space, I took this determinant of this matrix, determinant of k, called as p of z and w, and setting p of z and w equal to 0, this is what's called the spectral curve of the Dyna model, and this curve is the one that appears in the mirror geometry. So this is kind of interesting. We have this this simple statistical mechanical model here. All I'm doing is counting random matches of this graph. and this random discrete process gives me encodes mirror symmetry. I can obtain both sides of the mirror. So this obviously needs to be understood better in terms of both physics, string theory, and also mathematics. I can say a few words about what's going on here. So there are three parts of the picture. So basically we have in the middle we have some bipartite graph. And if you want to think about this as being made up of managed light brains that are stretched in the that extend in the 3 plus 1 non-compact directions, and then these things live in, this is the 4-6 plane. So these things live in one direction in the 4-6 plane. I don't know how to indicate this. So one direction here, and then some direction in the transverse, 5-7 directions. So the problem we started looking at was thinking about how to study the multi-space of a D3 brain that sits at a single point in the clavier. So in getting from here to here, I kind of made the jump that I indicated. But what I believe is happening is that so these two pictures are related by T-dividing. So we have T-dividing along two of these directions. So sort of two T-dividings here. I should point out. So similar picture to the one I'm describing was described by Aganovich. Karch. And image. And I forget the reference for that, but it's the paper on T-duality of brain configurations. So they were looking at the brain box picture, which I mentioned earlier, it's not being very well motivated. But our proposal is basically a way to reinterpret their brain box model. And so they discussed how the brain box model is related to firstly on this side to the study of D3 brains living at singular points. And then over here, if we take a T-duality along so this is along two of these directions, this is along a third direction. Because my conventions are different, I don't know how to don't remember which ones it is. But basically over here is where you have some six brains wrapping a three cycle in this geometry. Geometry there. And so the combination of these three T-dualities, the directions we're T-dualizing along are the three isometries, or three U1 isometries of the toric space. And so the combination of these two is mirror symmetry. And so this is the sense in which, so here we start with some clavier, and then here is mirror. And the link is through this intersecting D5 brains, and D5 minus 5 brains, which we've studied using data models. So here's the sense in which the mirror symmetry exists in string theory. But the fact that you can study this with data models is very interesting. For example, there has been work where you can compute the instanton numbers of these toric spaces from the data model. There's something called the Rankin function, which basically, from the Rankin function, you can extract all of the homomorphic, you can count the homomorphic curves in the clavier. That's something very non-trivial that's encoded in this combinatorial problem. So that's been studied by mathematicians, or a mathematician, and no one so far has made use of that in the string theory community. So since I have a few minutes, I'll just mention briefly some of the other things that we can see or read off from this construction of using bipartite graphs to study the quivers. First thing is, the vertices here are turned into superpotential. So clearly, if I have a massive field, it's going to appear like this. It turns out you can implement, if you want to study the infrared dynamics, you have to integrate out these fields because they will decouple. And this is now deleting this node of the graph, and then I even draw the neighbor here, but then I just coalesce this neighbor and this neighbor, and I guess with a vertex of higher valence. So this thing you can implement directly on the matrix, the JTC matrix. Something else you can look at on the graph is to study cybergirlie. So without going into details, so if I have a face of the graph which is a square, and then some other edges coming out here, then cybergirlie on the square, I remove the square, so I had edges here, and then I glue in a smaller square, and then I have the same edges out here. So previously the rectangle was going here, I've deleted them. And so this operation is cybergirlie. It's really toric cybergirlie. I started in a toric phase here, and I ended in another toric phase. That's because I did this on a square. If I did it on an hexagon or something else, it would no longer be toric. So this thing is also a very simple operation you can encode as an operation on the Castellane matrix. So you can study all these things like cybergirlie just in terms of the graph, properties of the graph. And then finally you can read off things like F-turn constraints from sort of graphical equations from this here, because here is a term in the superpotential, here is another term. These are the two terms that both include this common field. So then its closure of motion basically says this product of fields equal to this product of fields. And using this, we're able to prove that the results we get by studying the common torics of these graphs is equivalent to computing the Modulus space of this toric theory to start with. In particular, prove that it's equivalent to the Ford algorithm that Anani and collaborators developed 5 years ago. And so we call it the fast forward algorithm because it's much more efficient. Okay, so let me summarize. What we found was a more efficient way, a more compact way of representing the data of quiver theory. At least the toric theories, this is where it's most powerful. Perhaps some generalization of this applies to non-toric theories. And the point is it combines both the matter fields and their interactions into one object. Previously, if you use Wright in some traditional way, these things are separate. And in keeping them separate, you lose some of the structure, which is important for understanding it. So I propose that the construction of this dual graph, brain tiling, is something that you can study in string theory, has meaning in terms of intersecting D5 frames and M5 frames. And this relates to previous constructions of previous similar constructions, but clarifies some of the points were less clear in its previous works. And these bipartite graphs are natural playgrounds of these data models. This is something we don't have a good physical understanding of, so this is an important open problem. But it nonetheless works, and we've proved in general that we do obtain the correct moduli space of these gauge theories. So there's a huge literature of of results on data models, both in the physics and mathematics literature. These things are studied in StatMet. People use them to study properties of condensed matter, conformal field theory. And also, there's been a lot of work in the combinatorics literature about these, and also recently in algebraic geometry. So there's a huge wealth of results that have been obtained over, you know, almost 40 years. And there should be a lot of interesting stuff that's lurking in there that needs to be sort of dug out and then translated into string theory. So we're in the process of trying to do some of this. I think there's probably a lot more to be mined out of this this field. I should also mention, so the first people to study data models in string theory were Bartha, Concord, and Rishitikin, who were looking at topological strings and relating data models to computing Cartesian function topological string theory. They proposed the connection, but they didn't really work it out in detail, so that's still actually an open problem. They discussed or worked out the properties of the crystal models, which are related, of course, but they didn't work it out in detail. And there should be some relation of the ideas that I've been talking about, studying quiver theories, to studying topological strings on these non-compact toric spaces. So the areas that I'm currently thinking about are in terms of worrying about supersymmetry of these brain configurations. This is going to fix particular classes of embeddings of these graphs. We know some results about maximization, how to implement this on the graphs, and it should hopefully be compatible with the first point, if it's not just a nice mathematical trick. And finally, there's interesting neurosymmetry lurking in here, and there are no results about how to obtain tensile numbers from combinatorics of data models that should be explored in more detail. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you.